Welcome to the September edition of BBRO Beatcast. I'm Francesca Broom, your host and Knowledge Exchange Manager for BBRO. In the next few weeks, I'm sure most of you will be studying the recommended list and looking for your 2025 sugar beet varieties. But I doubt any of you will do so to the depth of my next guest, who has 52 years' experience of sugar beet trials and has been heavily involved behind the scenes in collecting and processing data for the support of growers. But before we catch up with Tricia Cullimore, let's look at something a little more pressing. From the calls and emails we're currently receiving, many of you are evaluating past or considering future use of cover crops. With so many species and conflicting claims, it is a complicated area to investigate. But work is underway, and we are therefore catching up with George and Alistair to hear their thoughts. Let's start with you, Alistair, because you've actually done previous work on BCN and cover crops in the way of trapping and mitigating the issues there. So let's have an overview from you first as to your previous experiences.
Well, that's right, Ches. So as part of my PhD research, we're going way back in time, 2016 and 17. We looked at using brassica trap crops, so specifically bread, mustard and radish cultivars, to reduce nematode numbers. It is really important if you are using a brassica as one of your cover crops to use one of these resistant types, and there's two types available, class 1s and class 2s. If you have any BCN or you suspect BCN, use a resistant type. I'm not going to promise that they're going to offer magical reductions of BCN. Certainly, that's not what we saw back in my own research. And they're marketed as having up to a 90% reduction, but that biologically is never going to happen. That's not how the nematode works. But use those class ones. They are the most resistant to offer you that any chance of a slight reduction. But the last thing you want to do is put a susceptible radish or mustard in. We've seen a lot of cases come in to plant clinic this year, people with nematode issues. It's been a perfect year for nematodes, and with the weather staying as wet as it is, we're going to see a perfect autumn for nematodes as well, and we don't want to offer them a host.
And you said the perfect word there was magical. And if you read some of the literature that's out there, then cover crops are quite magical, aren't they? They're going to deliver so much for the industry. But George, you're actually looking at it at a slightly different angle, and I have mixed views.
I think it's really interesting, Ches. There's people that swear by cover crops, they have great success with them. There's others that have tried cover crops. We carried out a survey last year. There's a lot of people that have tried cover crops and moved away from them now because they weren't successful. But we have a lot of interesting conversations, and there's a lot of different motivations for why people grow cover crops. So they might succeed in one area and not another. So that can be difficult to pick out. Someone's failure of a cover crop might not be a failure in another aspect. Ideally, they might be growing it, say, for grazing. It didn't put enough biomass on, the sheep didn't fatten well enough, but actually did that help improve soil health, or did that retain nutrients over winter? If it did, there is a success there. So sometimes it's just getting clear what people are trying to achieve with their cover crops. That then normally brings us on to the question of what do we recommend? There's a lot of people that do approach BBRO wanting recommendations on what cover crop species they should use. It's very difficult, and I'm not trying to avoid giving an answer there. I'm not dodging at all.
But there isn't a blueprint, is there? And, yeah, we can't expect that. And the same with most of the crops. There is no blueprint as to this is the way it must be done.
Yeah, precisely that. So I think our role really is to make sure we have relevant, robust and reliable information out there for growers to make the decisions that fit their systems. And it's also quite a challenging one for us to do research on because there's so many permutations, so many options out there. It's very hard to do big replicated trials that are going to give you real insightful data. We are doing that sort of work. That there's work that has gone on in the past by other organisations, but there's an opportunity really for us now to compile what is out there in a way that's digestible and relevant to sugar beet growers, so they're better informed when they're making decisions for what cover crop they want to put in ahead of next year's sugar beet.
And we spoke earlier in this year about your cover crop survey, and that's actually on one of the previous beet casts. And also about what you're doing this year, and you're testing various species. From that, when are we going to be able to release any information regarding those?
So, yeah, as well as people wanting to know what species mixes to have based on what they achieve and whether this timing of destruction, etc. And we do obviously have a lot of questions on the risk of green bridging, so whether different cover crop species are hosting virus. So that's question number one. And then question number two is whether there's then a risk of the aphid feeding on those cover crops and transmitting into the sugar beet. Question one's easy for us to address. So Eleanor Towler's doing work at the moment assessing different cover crop species with the three viruses to see if they are hosts. Those results should be preliminarily available by the end of this year. But we do want to revisit some of that data at the moment. They'll very much be provisional results at this moment in time. But there are some species we have a little bit more data from previously that we'll be more confident in giving advice on. So that will be out again by the end of the year. The bigger question and the one that's really challenging and I just want to raise is just because those species might host virus doesn't mean that they're going to act as a good enough source of infection if the aphid doesn't then feed on them to acquire the virus to then spread it into the sugar beet crop as well. So there's two very distinct things that we need to look at here, and we need the two together to actually give a concrete answer.
And the project we're doing is actually in the environs and things here, whereas in the commercial world and commercial field, it's very different if the aphids have then got a choice as to what they can feed on.
Precisely that, Ches. So we're artificially inoculating the cover crops, so they're grown in controlled environment in glass houses and growth cabinets, and we put the aphids on the plants. As you say, in the wild, they might not even have an interest at landing and feeding on those plants. So it is still artificial to some extent, so that's just worth bearing in mind as well.
And I know that what you're looking at the moment is we're trying to come to, put together a risk and reward matrix that we hope to have out in mid-August.
Yeah, definitely that. So me and Alistair are working on that at the moment. I'm very much looking at the sort of soil health and physiology side of things, and nutrition as well, whereas Alistair's looking at the pest and disease risk side of things. I think it's been a really interesting season from pest and disease point of view, as Alistair's pointed out, with the nematodes, but also slugs. Sugar beet isn't a crop you normally associate with being too at risk from excessive slug damage. I think it's been quite an intense season for slugs, to the point where it actually has affected some of our crops and some of our trials. A couple of trials I've had this year, even I've been taken aback by just how damaging the slugs have been. And they were both sites that were post-cover crop as well. So it's another thing to consider.
And I think that's been seen by a lot of the growers from the conversations we've been having. So hopefully by the time we get to our August beetfield events, and we do understand this impacts quite a bit with the harvest, but we've got so much information we want to get out on a timely basis that we do hope you'll join us in August. And we'll present the details then. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jez.
As mentioned, we'll be discussing cover crops further at our demo farm events held in this August. Monday the 19th at Morley, Norfolk. 20th, Peterborough. 21st, Selby in Yorkshire. And the 22nd at Yaxley in Suffolk. Now, from cover crops to covering a crop. Our next guest has over 50 years' experience of working in sugar beet, so stay with us as we hear from Tricia Cullimore.
I'm really pleased to be joined by two special guests. I suppose I can call Stephen Aldis special. He's our head of operations for BBRO. But really special guest joining me today is Tricia Cullimore. And Tricia has a long history in sugar beet, and although there be only a few of you that might have heard the name before, you have all been on the receiving end of the work that she's been doing for the industry for how many years, Tricia?
52 years and 9 months.
There you go. So Tricia's just taken retirement and she's been working with NIAB and on the RL for us. So I'm going to just start with Tricia. We've just been briefly talking a moment ago, and you were telling me about your earliest memories of sugar beet. And I think that's quite interesting to find a little bit about your previous, your family and history. So, yeah, just tell us that again.
Well, I grew up on a farm in Abington, South Camps. It's a chalk farm, quite poor soil, grew very good malting barley. We won awards for that. But one of my earliest memories with my dad is standing down the field. I was obviously quite small, and coming over the brow of the hill was this line of men with hoes, obviously singling for sugar beet. So this would be about 1959, I suppose. I was 4 or 5. And Dad just standing there and said to me, "Oh, look at all those men I've got to pay." And I think looking, sort of did a brief look back on the history of beet. And of course, this was before monogerm varieties had come in. There was all multigerm. I'm not sure what the equipment was like at the time, but I know we had a really old catchpole harvester in the bushes for some years. And I think he just got to the point where he thought, this isn't worth it. It's too much. It's too much effort. I might as well sow, well, he'd be sowing malting barley, because that was the main crop that we got our money from.
Isn't it amazing that people, they used to just park the machinery under a tree and leave it for the year. I can't imagine that happening with you, Stephen, can it, with our kit?
We try not to.
I've tried to find a picture yesterday of the catch pole that we had, because I think it was trailed, and it had a massive seat high up and a big steering wheel. I've actually got the plate from it.
Yeah.
So if anybody has done any work on the history of catch pole harvesters, I'd love to contact them.
And I know you've kept a wealth of history of the industry, and we've just been looking at one of the RL trials and the report for 1972. And it's amazing the things that they're discussing there, which a lot of it we're still talking about today, aren't we?
Yes, things do change, but the emphasis of certain things, bolters, they're all still the key issue.
And you said that when you started in the industry, monogerm was the main seed that was coming through. How long do you think it took to actually make that change from the multi-germ to monogerm?
Well, the last multi-germ variety that was recommended was in 1979.
Yeah.
So it took about 15 years. I mean, about 1966, there weren't any monogerm varieties on the recommended list. So Dad would be pleased. And funnily enough, it took him 35 years to go back into it.
Oh, good that he returned to it then.
Yes, yeah. When we joined up with Bartlow Estates, they had John Goodchild, who some of your listeners might know, was into his beet, his favourite crop, and they were doing contracting for us, my brother was working with them as well, so it was kind of a very mutual kind of thing. Anyway, he persuaded us to go back into the beet, and we've been in it ever since.
So do you remember, like, when you first started, obviously you started actually with NIAB as a job role, so what was your first day like?
Well, it was a Friday, actually, 1st of October 1971. I always thought that was a really good day to start, because everyone was quite relaxed. And they took me down the field and said, this is a trial, you won't understand it, but we'll explain it, some other time. And it was a sweet trial, and I went, well, it looks like there's about 12 varieties mixed up in four beds. And they were quite surprised, but I mean, it wasn't difficult, because Swedes don't grow very well in Cambridge. They get a lot of mildew. And obviously, they're different shapes and colours. And so, So I kind of got the trial design thing straight away,
yeah.
which I think they're quite pleased. They're also quite pleased I was a farmer's daughter. So I get introduced as, this is Tricia. She's a farmer's daughter. And everyone went, good. And I thought, why did I bother to go to school and get just said I was a farmer's daughter all these years?
And what was the job? Was it you actually having to do?
It was a trials assistant, basically. Yeah. So, but I helped with everything. So we did all the reports, we did all the meetings, but we also did all the trial work as well.
When you started, how many different crops were you looking at, or was it just sugar beet?
We were in the root and fodder section. So sugar beet, mangels, fodder beet, swedes. All the catch crops that people today, like fodder radish, turnips, and sweet kale, forage rape, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, quite fashionable these days, aren't they?
Yeah.
And over the years, I gained oilseed rape, maize. I did a little bit of herbage, sunflowers, mustard, you name it. But the one crop I kept from day one to the last day was the sugar beet.
Yeah.
And I got quite stubborn about it. There was various reorganisations where I was going to lose it, and I just got a bit stroppy and said no.
Yeah. Well, we're certainly pleased that you kept it.
I don't know why, but I think there's just something about the. It was just something about it all that just appealed to me.
And how have you seen the industry move on in your time? Because obviously, from 1970s to 2020s, there's a lot has happened.
Well, as we said, I was there when the monogerm was coming in, and I did a little sort of timeline of things. I was quite interested to just sort of look and see what had actually happened. there were some notable events while I was, sort of national events. So, of course, we joined the EU in 73. And, of course, we left the EU in that, so I was,
And did that have much impact on the sugar beet industry, do you think?
Joining the EU had a big impact because we started doing national listing of varieties. I can't really tell you quite how it worked before, but obviously the national listing, as most, well, I don't know if people know, but that has to, a variety has to be national listed before it can be sold. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it then goes on, whatever crop it is, and then it will go on to further testing if they want either descriptive list or recommended list. So, of course, with the sugar beet, it was a recommended list.
Yeah.
So, yes, that had a big impact because that's VCU and varieties of value for cultivation and use, and DUS, distinctness, uniformity, stability. And they have to get both components to pass both components to get on the national list. So, and I worked on both of those aspects, so that's trial work and actually sort of measuring the leaves and stuff in my time.
I would imagine sort of in the sort of 70s, obviously, we had all the problems with rhizomania. Must have been quite a challenge.
So, actually, the first recorded outbreak of rhizomania was 1987. Mm-hmm. And in all the recommended lists for several years, it was mentioned that the breeders are working hard on trying to get rhizomania resistant varieties. The first variety to actually get listed on the list was in 1998.
Well, I hadn't realised it took that long.
Yeah. Well, they've been in trial. Obviously, to be on the recommended list, you have to be in trial for 3 years.
Yeah.
And the thing with the rhizomania varieties, they were obviously very low yielding compared to the others, and they were tested in the absence of the disease. So it wasn't until about 2000 that we were able to sow the varieties on infected sites. Because obviously there had to be approval to be able to do that.
And at what point did neonic then come in? Because I thought that was around about the same time, isn't it?
I believe you're about right, yeah. I think so. I'll have to check the... we always see it on the graph every year with the yellows forecast and when the neonics came and went. So, it must have been around that time.
I think it was 2013, they were all rhizomania varieties. Mm.
So it must be quite a challenge that, I mean, we talk about just brought that in, so you've got hopefully some stable seed coming in for rhizomania, and then we have the other issues with virus yellows, and you've got then other chemicals spraying. So it must be quite daunting if you're doing trials and then looking at the data coming and then knowing it's going to be treated with pelleting or whatever that could potentially change the results of from what you've done in field from a trial as to what a grower's seeing.
So that's where you as statisticians come into. So it's one thing, which I'm not, but you have to get their advice all the time when you do trials design. So my ex-colleagues, I should say, Heidi Philpott and Andy Horwell, you talk to them about the trial design, because it's one thing thinking, we can shove all these things into a trial and then we can extract the information, but it doesn't work like that. You have to have proper trial design and then know how you're going to work with the data. So, and that was the same when we did the rhizomanias and any new thing that was coming through. Doesn't happen so much these days because cost implications, but in the past, as you've looked in that 71 book that I've just shown you, there was a lot of proving trials in the old days, but there was a bit more money around. Yeah.
No, don't talk about money when Stephen's here, because when he's always being pushed to try and deliver the trials.
Exactly. Yeah, so the rhizomania was, a success story. And obviously, when you get all these varieties, people don't really realise what's happening. I mean, NIAB's been coordinating these for the various bodies, not just BBRO, but lots of different organisations for many years. So we have a good system, and we know what to look for. You're doing something like harvesting. I mean, I used to be in the tear house doing
mobile
a rye.
Tear house,
well, it's called the hell hole.
Yeah. Oh, mobile ones. I've seen some pictures of those.
I saw those. It's a bit like Concord. They've been and gone.
Yeah.
I've seen that technology go. And no offence to Stephen, but you're actually harvesting the trials exactly how I did it in 1971 when I first arrived. So lifting the beet, putting them into bags, putting the label on them, and taking them to a factory. So that's what happened when I first arrived. We used to take them to Peterborough. There was a what they called Central Laboratory at Peterborough. We also got the data from there, and I used to have to go up there and collect this data. It was either on huge green sheets, you know, those dot matrix printed sheets.
And you were working off paper, weren't you? They weren't quite the same systems we now have nowadays of spreadsheets.
Well, that's the other thing. I didn't think that, because obviously when I first started, we didn't have any computers. It was all by hand. We had the statisticians. They were brilliant. We didn't have to do too much sort of that stuff. But it was the sum work that we had to do, punching in data and stuff. But, I was a bit of a whiz on the electronic calculators. You know, it was big as a desk. And they had this, like, ticket roll stuff coming out. And, of course, you had to write the answers down. But you take it for granted. I mean, people say to me, well, you know, you must have seen loads of changes. But if you work in agriculture, you grow up in agriculture, changes happen all the time. They'll happen suddenly, but you've had a year to think about some of them. So my dad was always modifying machines and stuff to help at home, and we went from sacks, putting the corn in, to bulk loading, and he devised all these augers and everything, and it was, the whole barn was full of augers to get it from there to there, because there was no way that he was going to shovel it or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And so you grow up with that kind of idea that it doesn't have to always be like that.
And it's amazing how the whole industry's moved on. So we've got huge progress when it comes to mechanisation. And then, as you said, we go back to things like, you know, Stephen still having to harvest in the same way that you did back in the 70s.
Mm. Interesting how many people were involved for you to do it compared to what we operate now. Even though the process is the same, you know, the outputs, I'm sure, of...
Now, just be careful here, Tricia, because what he's hoping to do is you're going to say he needs 10 more staff members.
The same, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
And the number of plots, it's just, I mean, reading these trial books is fascinating. I mean, so much has changed, but yet so much is the same.
Yeah.
Really.
I think we had about the same number of people. And the only difference probably, probably there was less varieties. I know we used to have two discards to have to harvest all the way around, so it slowed everything down.
Yeah.
So, but I used to get a rest then.
Let someone else do that.
Twice, you know.
And what was the yield like for you first started to where we are now?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because yesterday...
I was just reading that in this report. I think it was 3.5 tonnes of sugar per acre.
I looked at the... So this is from the recommended list. So it said that the root yield in 1974 was 48.5 tonnes per hectare. I looked in 2024, and it was 95.4.
That's huge growth, isn't it?
Interesting, the sugar content, 3 years of data to make the recommended list in 1974, it was 16.8. But, I mean, I did it every 10 years, so it was 74, 16.8, 84, 16.9. Then 94 and 2004, they were in the 18s. But, you see, this could be due with climate change and stuff.
Yeah.
And then... 2014 was 18.5, and then the last one was 17.2. So sugar's sort of stayed about the same in a way.
Is it the same in the way of a plant stand? Did that change much in your career?
Yes, because of monogerm. But monogerm, I'd only been working there for about 2-3 years, and we actually started planting to a stand, and all the trials were planted to a stand, so not less than 15 centimetres. So basically, I've been doing that my entire career. But it's ironic, isn't it? Because I was standing there in the field with my dad, like 4 or 5, and a little did I know that sort of 12 years later, it would be the start of a career that involved sugar beet for the rest of my life. I mean, when I started at NIAB, I wasn't, you know, you never think you're going to stay.
Over the years, has there ever been a standout variety that you... Yeah, we all hear the same ones, and they turn over so quickly, and there are one or two... names that I remember going back for years that I think, that sticks in my mind. I just wonder, is there anything you think, I remember that one, and why it stands out?
Do you ever actually work in names though, Tricia? Because everything we ever do is coded products. Yeah, so you just know the number of them rather than its actual name, I don't know.
AFP numbers, it's given the number when a breeder enters it into the national list system, then it gets that number for the rest of its life. Don't ask me what NFP stands for, because I don't know.
Right, okay.
After 50-odd years, I still don't know what it means. But anyway, yes, well, when I first started, there was these three varieties of monogen, Amono, Bushmono, and Hillisog monitroi. And I do remember those, because Amono was on the recommended list for 17 years.
God.
So it was first listed in 67, and it actually came off the list. Its last listing was in 1983. And Hillisog monitroi, that went on the same year in 67, and that came off in 85.
We're lucky to keep them now for what, 3 years, 4 years?
I've got a few long servers now, and Daphne's been on for seven. So, yeah.
But maybe some of your older listeners might remember those varieties, because they obviously were very popular, and I mean, they would only stayed on the list if they were decent enough. So
yeah, and they're obviously, you know, over that time they must have had a reasonable stable yield.
The thing that really, well, it didn't hit the recommended list, obviously, or GM trials.
Mm-hmm.
So breeders, and I can't remember the time span, but I think it was the mid-90s. That was a challenge, because there was all the regulations to abide by and everything. Quite a few of them got trashed. And
I was going to say, did you have any protests around them?
Sometimes it was a bit scary, because we turned up at one trial and all these people in white boiler suits. We rang our boss, well, don't go down there, stay there. And after a while he rang us back and said, it's okay, it's another organisation, they're students, they've just got to pay for boilers. Relief, but And, of course, at the same time, we had the foot-and-mouth epidemic. That was in 2001. We managed to carry on with the programme, but obviously we had to take foot baths, and I think the chemical was called Antec, and it really stank. And, you know, we now had to tell everyone at work where we were going and get approval where we were going and all this sort of thing. Yeah, it wasn't good.
Yeah, difficult time.
And then, of course, COVID. Well, by the time COVID came along, I was confined to barracks, though I was actually not doing trial work. But, you know, I must say that all the trials teams, whether it was NIAB or BBRO or the breeders, they all did a marvellous job, because they found a way to work. But
it was stressful, I know, for here, because you particularly, Stephen, were trying to manage things.
Yes, I mean, it was the year I came into the trials team in March 2020. So I met Tricia for the first time on Teams, and I think I didn't meet you in person for 3 years. It was very useful to me. I was new to the RL programme, and I'm sure you've heard the wealth of knowledge was very useful to me, and all the things I needed to be doing at certain times of the year, and reminders, and having my team get more. Up until 2 weeks ago, we'd get a weekly email from Tricia reminding us what we needed to submit and what we needed to do. So, it's strange how we met, but there you go. I still learned a lot from you.
I think it was helpful that I'd actually done the trial work when you get new people coming, like Stephen and that, because I might not have done it for a long time, but you never forget.
And it's good to have that practical experience to be able to pass it on and understand the issues in field for those doing it.
And also, you have more sympathy when people go, I can't get it to harvest, it's wet. And you're like, yeah, I know what it was like.
And all that data has always led to the RL, which has obviously gone out to growers and hopefully steered the whole of the industry.
Yeah. My most important thing was this job fitted perfectly what I felt I needed to do. I needed to do something that was meaningful and give back and help growers by choosing the best varieties that they could. And that was my main... That's always what drove me. And the farmer was my dad or my brother or their neighbours. You know, I always had them in my mind. The society that we have today, it's very hard for the farmers. You know, the society doesn't really understand them or appreciate what they do. I just feel, I just thank them all for doing what they do. And I'm just pleased to have been a small part of it.
Well, I think after 52 years, I think we can safely say you've certainly done your bit. And we as a sugar beet industry and BBRO really appreciate the time and your attention to detail and just your approachable manner. It's been brilliant for all of us. So I think on behalf of all of us, thank you very much for what you've done.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Tricia. And thank you for the humour along the way as well. It's always funny to get Tricia on a Teams call.
On behalf of the industry, I would just like to wish Tricia all the very best for her retirement and to remind you of our Beatfield events in August. That's the 19th, 20th, 21st and 22nd. Please book via the events tab on the BBRO website. Again, apologies, this is mid-August, but we have got a lot of information to get out to you, including the very latest on the cover crops. And if you would like to have basis points, this podcast is worth one. And the number you need is CP/139339/2425/K. If you haven't started already, good luck for the rest of harvest. And thank you very much for listening.